This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We tend to think of autism as a modern disease, or as my next guest, Steve Silberman, writes, the unique disorder of our uniquely disordered times. But that idea, he says, doesn't quite square with history. His new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, explores that history. He takes us back to Vienna before the Second World War, where he introduces us to a young doctor named Hans Asperger. That's a familiar name to many of you. Back in the 1930s, Asperger was already studying what he believed to be a widespread condition among the children of his day, a mostly heritable condition composed of a whole spectrum of symptoms. Yet despite these insights, Silberman writes that Asperger was largely left out of the textbooks. We'll let him continue the story in a moment. Steve Silberman is a science writer and the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. He joins us today from KQED. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here.
And we do have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/neurotribes. And if you want to join us, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So continue the story for us of Hans Asperger in wartime Vienna.
Well, he was an extremely visionary and humane clinician. His clinic was not just the sort of place where parents would bring their children for evaluation and a diagnosis, but it was also like a residential school. So Asperger and his colleagues actually lived with the children intimately, and they had classes there. Each day they would study a new subject like geometry or history. They had PE classes with music in the morning. And so it was really a total environment that was designed to both allow the clinicians to observe the children very closely, but also allow them to become more comfortable with themselves and with each other, because many of them had been considered very difficult children. They had been expelled from a series of schools. Some of the children had been sent there by the courts. So in a way, Asperger's clinic was sort of a clinic of last resort for many of the children. But Asperger and his colleagues made it a very, very wonderful place. Asperger himself would occasionally just sit with the children and read poetry to them, actually. Mm. So it was a very, very humane environment and way ahead of its time in that way. And the ideas about autism that Asperger and his colleagues developed there were decades ahead of their time. For example, Asperger and his colleagues conceived of autism as a lifelong condition lasting from birth to death, requiring special forms of support from the family and teachers and the community. He saw the very, very broad range of what we now call the autism spectrum. So some children were unable to speak and might require individual support for the rest of their lives, while others, one of his very profoundly disabled former young patients ended up sort of begging his teachers to give him advanced classes in math and science. And he ended up going to graduate school, finding a flaw in one of Isaac Newton's proofs and becoming an assistant professor of astronomy, even though he was still very autistic, blatantly autistic, as Asperger put it, and couldn't even recognize the faces of familiar people passing in the street. So Asperger knew really a lot about autism, and he had a great team of colleagues there. But then, as anyone who's familiar with European history of the late 1930s knows, something very, very bad happened, which was that the Nazis marched into Austria and annexed the country for the German fatherland. And around the same time, the Nazis started passing eugenic laws, which compelled any form of clinicians and nurses to report disabled children to Berlin. And in fact, the Nazis eventually undertook a secret extermination program of disabled children and adults as part of their effort to purge the gene pool of hereditary forms of illness, as they put it. And that actually became the dry run for the Holocaust. That was where the Nazis developed methods of mass murder that they would eventually use on the Jews. So at that point, Asperger had to protect the children in his clinic from even his own supervisors at the hospital. And in fact, the Gestapo came to the clinic to arrest him several times. But luckily, a supervisor of his, who was a very prominent Nazi, liked him and seemed to protect him from the Gestapo. So Asperger was doing amazing work under the worst possible conditions, I would say.
And I'm wondering if you can talk more about some of the symptoms that he was describing, because when we hear his name, we think of the condition Asperger's syndrome, but he was really describing a much broader spectrum than that, or maybe even perhaps a broader spectrum than the autism spectrum that we talk about today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what he described was pretty mapped pretty much close to what we now call the autism spectrum. But he described children who would engage in kind of repetitive behavior, were very much disliked and bullied by their peers, could not seem to pick up on the fact that they would sort of talk endlessly about the subjects of their fascination and not pick up on the signals that they were boring the people they were talking to. One of the reasons why Asperger, I think, was fascinated by these children was because he himself had sort of a reputation when he was young of being a kind of tedious, pedantic kid. And he was obsessed with this poet who was sort of a goth poet in a way named Grill Parser. And so, you know, he would get lost in books for days on end and forget that he had to do his homework. So I think one of the reasons why Asperger related to these children was that he himself was an odd outcast child, and he became fascinated with these children who seemed to move through the world in a kind of private world of their own. And so those were the children he described. But one of the things that I discovered to write the book was the very first talk on autism that was ever given in history by Hans Asperger in 1938 to what was certainly an audience of Nazis, because he was speaking to his supervisors and the country had been completely swept by the mania for Hitler. And what he did was he said that he is describing his most promising cases. And I think the reason why he described his most promising cases in the paper he would eventually write was that he knew that if he described his, you know, less promising cases, that the Nazis would target them for extermination.
We're talking, so, yeah. I just wanted to let our audience know that we're talking with Steve Silberman, who's the author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. If you want to join us, 844-724-8255. That's 844-PSY-TALK. And all of the work that Asperger did that you describe in the book in many ways is forgotten by much of history, in part because of a rivalry with another scientist named Leo Kanner. Can you just tell us about that rivalry and why we know about autism more through that lens than through the Asperger lens today?
Well, what's so fascinating that I actually discovered for the book, no one's ever written about this, is that one of the things that happened under the Nazis was that Jewish clinicians had to flee the country or die. And one of the clinicians who was forced to flee the country was George Frankl, who was Asperger's chief diagnostician. And another colleague of Asperger's who also fled the country was a woman named Annie Weiss, who wrote really the first case history of an autistic child from Asperger's clinic. Anyway, they leave the country. Where do they go? They go to Baltimore because they're rescued. Well, Annie wasn't. She actually went to America earlier. But George is rescued from the Holocaust by an American clinician named Leo Kanner. It looks like Kanner, but it's actually Kanner. So what happened was George Frankl started working for Leo Kanner in 1938, and they got along very well. They would lead public clinics together where parents would bring their children for evaluation, in fact. And so another person who arrived in Leo Kanner's world in 1938 was a kid named Donald Triplett. And Donald Triplett is considered Leo Kanner's first autistic patient. In fact, he's considered sort of the first autistic patient because Kanner got his paper out a year before Asperger's. Anyway, so he shows up at Kanner's clinic, and Kanner doesn't know what to do with him. He has seen some of these symptoms before in children that he called pre-psychotic, but he basically isn't able to make a diagnosis. And so he sends sends Donald Triplett to George Frankel for evaluation. Well, George Frankel was quite familiar with children like this because he had just spent 11 years working in Asperger's clinic, seeing scores of autistic children, perhaps up to a couple of hundred, at all levels of ability. So Frankel knew just what to make of Donald Triplett. And in fact, Frankel evaluated Kanner's first three autistic patients. And so then in 1943, Kanner writes his paper that makes him the world's leading authority on autism. And it begins with the statement, since 1938, a number of children have come to our attention, etc. And historians have sort of puzzled over that for a very long time. What does he mean by 1938? And then, you know, they came to the conclusion that what he means is that Donald Triplett showed up. Well, that's true, but George Frankel also showed up, who knew what to look for. And so the problem is, well, there are a couple of problems. For one thing, Kanner never mentioned Asperger's work ever in his voluminous writings on autism, which, you know, hundreds of papers. In fact, he doesn't mention Asperger's name in public until the 70s when he says, oh, yes, Asperger. It's kind of in a book review in the back of this obscure journal. He says, oh, yes, Asperger. That what that man discovered was, at best, a 42nd cousin of my syndrome that has already received serious attention. Because by then, Kanner had been the world's leading authority on autism. The problem for autistic people and their families was that Kanner defined autism much more narrowly than Asperger had done. For one thing, he called it early infantile autism. So it was definitely a condition of early infancy. Kanner also eventually, although he didn't do it at first, he eventually blamed parents for triggering autism in their children. The familiar image of the refrigerator mother came from Kanner's work, not the work of Bruno Bettelheim, although Bettelheim sort of made a career out of it later. But it was really Kanner who thought up that horrible idea. And what's so bad about that idea is that Kanner's recommended course of treatment for autism became institutionalization,
which is of course one of the problems that so many decades of people who are dealing with autism have faced. We want to get to some calls in a moment. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Chrissy, who's calling from South Carolina. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say I just downloaded the book because I'm very fascinated by it. It personally affects my family. I have a 10-year-old son with autism. And I think one of the interesting things about kids with autism is there's all these preconceived notions about what they're like and what they do. And my son is just one of the most wonderful kids you'd ever want to meet. And he has a lot of the strange little quirky things, you know, that you see with kids, but so many of the things are not what you expect. So I cannot wait to read this book. I think it's going to be very interesting. So thank you for writing.
That is so great to hear. It is so wonderful to hear about a mom who really appreciates her child and doesn't see him through the lens of all these false beliefs that accumulated in psychiatry over the decades.
Chrissy, thank you very much for your phone call. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking to Steve Silberman, whose book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Asperger talks about autistic intelligence, which you write was a quote, bold suggestion that autistic people have played an unappreciated role in the evolution of culture. And I think that's what Chrissy, I'm sure a lot of callers right now and listeners might want to talk about, is the gifts of the autistic person.
That's the thing. Asperger appreciated the gifts and aptitudes of his kids. And in fact, he had to overcome a kind of personal skepticism at first about these gifts because, for one thing, he noticed that a lot of his young patients seemed to be fascinated with science fiction and rocket ships. And at first he wrote, "One can see how remote from reality, you know, the interests of autistic children are." Anyway, he would take back that statement later once the whole world had become obsessed with rocket ships, in a sense, which was not that long after that. So Asperger always appreciated that autism was a condition that conveyed both profound disabilities and very special gifts. Connor, on the other hand, interpreted even the gifts of his patients through sort of the lens of psychopathology. So he thought that, for instance, one of the kids in his clinic who could instantly identify 18 symphonies before he turned 2, Connor thought that boy was just trying to impress his parents and in a kind of desperate plea for their affection. So Connor had a much dimmer view of the special gifts of autistic kids than Asperger did.
The way you end your book is really as part of a plea to redesign the world to perhaps make it easier, more acceptable for autistic people. We have just about a minute and a half, please, Steve, but I'm wondering if you can go into that and talk about what the world might do to better adapt for autistic individuals.
Well, we know how to adapt to, for instance, people who use wheelchairs. We build accessible buildings and make curb cuts so that they can freely travel around. So we can do a cognitively accessible world by, say, presenting lessons and curricula in different formats for visual or audio learners. We can provide quiet spaces in schools so that kids are, you know, who are like facing a meltdown because they're sensorily overloaded because they have autism, can go chill out. Mm-hmm. We can do autism-friendly performances on Broadway, which have already been a fantastic success, with less pyrotechnics and social stories beforehand so the kids don't get surprised. We know how to deal with disability, and we just have to rise to the challenge instead of thinking that we can make autism go away if we throw enough money at it.
Your book is a fascinating history, and I want to thank you for joining us. Steve Silberman is a science writer, the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism, and The Future of Neurodiversity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
If you'd like to read an excerpt of the book, it's at sciencefriday.com/neurotribes.